were at the beginning of the fourth industrial revolution, the first being the advent of steam power, you know, the second being the advent of the internal combustion engine and electricity, the third being the internet and all that that meant and brought in the 1990s and subsequent, and now, of course, most prominently, the unfolding of the application of artificial intelligence and machine learning.
Barefoot innovation starts right now.
Today's guest is a familiar name and face for everyone who follows U.S. politics. He is Tim Pawlenty, the CEO of the Financial Services Roundtable. Tim was previously governor of Minnesota and became well known to most of us when he ran for the 2012 Republican presidential nomination, where, among other things, he was a regular on the debate stage. He's been a prominent voice on public policy for many years. He was also a speaker on a panel that I moderated last fall at Money 2020 on financial innovation and regulation. And so we decided to take that conversation further when we came back to Washington. I visited him at the offices of the Roundtable, which is the trade association representing the largest U.S. banks and financial companies. Tim is one of the most thoughtful people we've ever had on the show. He has a comprehensive perspective on all the issues and a lot of strong opinions that he expresses with great clarity. He shared his predictions, for example, on how fintech is and isn't going to change banking, including its competitive structure, and including the likelihood of rising competition for the consumer's trust. He also talked about the big tech companies competing with banks, not in terms of whether it will happen, he thinks that's a given, but rather when and how it will ultimately be regulated. He also has some great thoughts on the respective strengths and weaknesses of banks versus companies like Amazon and Apple. Tim thinks cybersecurity is the top challenge facing the industry and talks about the foundational and structural difficulty of taking the internet, which was designed to be open and distributed, and trying to plug its security gaps with patches. He cites a roundtable event where Steve Wozniak offered some interesting perspective on this for them, albeit somewhat discouraging advice, I thought. Tim is an optimist that technology is going to make financial services vastly better for most people. He's also an optimist about banks and fintechs finding synergies and increasingly being able to partner with each other. And he thinks that a very, very few fintechs are going to change the world. He's less optimistic about U.S. financial regulators getting good at truly coordinating as technology changes the issues that are on their plates. As he puts it, the regulatory structure is horizontal rather than vertical, which makes it hard to develop harmonized thinking and actual standards that could help move the system forward. As he notes, government is a lagging indicator. Speaking of that, I should note that we had this conversation in late November, which means that our discussion of Bitcoin and cryptocurrency is lagging a bit behind the 2018 headlines. Big banks are going to play an enormous role in the shaping of finance as it undergoes digital transformation. More than small banks, they have the resources to lead a lot of innovation. More than fintechs, they have resources again, and also expertise in how to be regulated companies, which takes some learning. More than either, they'll end up in head-to-head contests with the big tech companies that are probably coming into finance. At the same time, though, really more than any of these players, big banks are hard to change by virtue of their sheer size and history, and also the legacy of being in some ways creatures of regulation. They're often on defense on regulatory and enforcement and political and public concerns about banking. I'll link in the show notes to episodes we've done with some other of the large banks, including Wells Fargo, Citi, and U.S. Bank, thinking about the innovation challenges ahead of them. Tim Pawlenty says in our show that banking is the plumbing of the economy and therefore has to work well. He's right about that, and given that metaphor, we could also say that big banks are the main pipes of this plumbing system. When they do innovation well, their many millions of customers will benefit. Most financial consumers today are served by these large institutions. If they do innovation badly, or if the regulatory process impedes the move to modernize them, then the future is going to be a whole lot more complicated. If you have thoughts about this episode, remember to tweet me at Joanne Barefoot. And now, please enjoy my conversation with Financial Services Roundtable CEO, Tim Pawlenty. I am delighted that we have such a special show today because my guest is Tim Pawlenty, the head of the Financial Services Roundtable. Welcome.
Well, I'm glad to be part of this podcast. Thanks for having me.
I'm so glad you're here. I know most of our listeners are very familiar with your background, especially the ones in the United States, but you are, among other things, the former governor of Minnesota and born and raised in Minnesota, I think.
Right.
And then you came to the Financial Services Roundtable.
About 5 years ago, so in the fall of 2012.
Great. So tell us about the Roundtable for starters. You represent the biggest financial institutions in the United States. Talk about that a little bit.
Sure, yeah. The full name is the Financial Services Roundtable, and so it's one of the alphabet soup of trade associations in Washington, D.C., and we represent some of the larger financial service companies in the country. In fact, to be a member, you got to be quite large by our membership standards. But we are a little different in the sense that we represent different sectors. Most trade associations focused on one line of business. We have banks of different sizes, but mostly larger. We have insurance companies, both property and casualty and life insurance and some others. We have payment companies, and we also have asset managers and investment service companies. So we sort of cover the waterfront of financial services, and it's a 100-year-old organization. It's mostly been a banking organization over the arc of its history, but post Gramm-Leach-Bliley, which is a name of legislation passed in the 1990s, the leaders of the roundtable decided to make it a multi-sector trade association, and that brings us to sort of the structure of today.
Yeah, that's great. I think the more we have sector diversity, maybe the better we move forward on some of these issues.
Well, there are some issues that cross sectors like cybersecurity, and it's good to everybody work together on issues like that because there's so much interconnectedness in the economy broadly, but certainly within financial services. But there are other issues that still are quite sector specific once you get into the nuances, you know, of banking regulation that gets to be quite bank specific.
Yeah, for sure. And one thing about your members is many of them are global. So you've got a lot of international reach, really, in the scope of what you do.
Yeah, many of our members are interested in cross-border issues, and whether it be tax reform or regulation here or in some other jurisdiction, that's certainly true. Cross-border issues are on top of mind for many of our members.
So I had the fun of having you on my panel at Money 2020 not too long ago, and we had a great conversation there about the future of innovation in finance. And as you know, our show looks at both the how technology innovation is changing finance and also the regulatory issues around that, which I know you're very, very, very much involved in. But I think maybe the best place to start is talk about how, from the standpoint of the very large financial companies, how do you see the evolution of technology change? How revolutionary or evolutionary is it? How much are you in the camp of thinking we're in a big disruption versus normal growth? Just talk about a
sure.
vision on that.
Well, stepping back from financial services and just looking at it more broadly, I think it's fair to say as a country, as a international collection of countries, we're at the beginning of the fourth industrial revolution, the first being the advent of steam power, the second being the advent of the internal combustion engine and electricity, the third being the internet and all of that meant and brought in the 1990s and subsequent. And now, of course, most prominently, the unfolding of the application of artificial intelligence and machine learning, but also next generation nanotechnology, next generation, biotechnology and the like, but with a particular emphasis on artificial intelligence and machine learning. And for your listeners who may not follow all of this, of course, with artificial intelligence, there's nothing really artificial about it. It's very smart humans who put together algorithms who can basically absorb or monitor and compute mass amounts of data, and then predict, you know, the next thing that will happen in the pattern. And over time, the machine can learn to do that itself without humans.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of applications to that. But as you think about financial services and the role of humans in financial services, I think we're facing and the next 10, 15 years is going to be a period where dramatic automation is going to set in on a lot of different platforms with a lot of different functions. I think financial services is particularly susceptible to that. So one piece of that is fintech, financial technology, and what does emerging technology mean to legacy institutions, incumbent financial practices. And I think 3-4 years ago, there was sort of this storyline that these big legacy institutions are just going to go away as these fintech companies eat their lunch. But I think really the story as it's unfolded is that there's partnerships, there is a view from the incumbent entities that they look to many fintech companies as their partner for R&D, for innovation, basically on an outsourced basis, and in some cases just buying and acquiring them. Tongue in cheek, one commentator said not long ago, there's approximately 6,500 fintech companies in the country, about 6,200 will be out of business in 5 years. But as to the remaining 300, many of them will be acquired. Some of them will, provide outsource R&D. Some of them will have interesting platforms that'll get, stand up on their own. And about 12 will change the world. And trying to predict which 12 that is very hard. But what we do know is, in our sector and many other sectors, automation is both a tremendous opportunity and going to be a tremendous challenge, particularly as it relates to workforce and how people access the workforce, how they train for the workforce, how they retrain if their job is disrupted. And I think financial services is going to look very different 10 years from now than it does now, with that as one of the overarching themes.
So, perfect segue. Can you tell me what you think it's going to look like in 15 years?
Well, I think it's going to look a lot more distributed. It's going to look a lot more mobile. It's going to look a lot more consumer and end user centric. I think the idea of whether it's an insurance or financial services, at least at the retail level, setting aside commercial for just a moment, of people filling out long forms and long meetings and cubicles with a financial person is going to fade, although that's still going to be very important for many. There's still a need and a want for people to interact, not just with apps or computers or robots, but humans. But I think you're going to see an increasing and continued migration towards basically automated access to everything.
And how about industry structure? Do you think it's going to be markedly different from what we have now?
I think in the sense that, take the mortgage process, for example. I mean, it is tedious, it's painful, it takes a lot of hours of filling out forms, it can take meetings, lots of processing, including with humans, and you've got, originators, and you've got servicers, and you've got underwriters. And I think in the world, if you fast forward 10 years, that certain platforms, rightly or wrongly, are going to know so much about you, they can just approve the loan or approve your mortgage just by verifying who you are. In fact, that's already happening. You look at a company called Green Sky as one example. I mean, they take a picture of your driver's license and can verify approval for a loan, in this case a home remodeling loan, in 15 seconds, or I guess in some cases 1 second. So the idea that you're going to go sit in a bank lobby and fill out a form and try to get a home remodeling loan and talk to some, early stage banker about how, getting a $20,000 loan for your house is probably going to fade as people just want to push a button on an app and decide whether they get it or not.
What do you think about the potential for the big tech companies to come into the financial services space, the Googles and
Amazon?
Well,
it's inevitable, I think. And they already are. I mean, I think they're certainly experimenting with various things. You think of Apple Pay, Google Pay. There's interest both in the past and prospectively with certain large companies wanting to be in the credit card industry or the credit industry. So I think that's highly likely, is to some extent already happening. And I think that changes the nature of it, because it's one thing for fill-in-the-blank little undercapitalized fintech startup to try to take on a legacy institution. It's another thing if Amazon or Google or Apple want to do it.
Yeah. There's talk about whether in an environment like that we might have the trusted tech company that's our go-to companion for social media or whatever become the sort of the layer between the consumer and the bank. Does that seem likely to you that they'll be the ones that'll sort of like cocoon you and coach you? And
yeah. Well, I think everybody wants that role.
So
you think about how people spend their time online. I think various companies, platforms are going to want to see themselves and already do see themselves as that intermediary for content and services. And it's not much of a leap to predict that certain companies that have the attention of consumers online are going to want to be the intermediary or the portal for everything, or try to.
Yeah.
And as that unfolds, I think there's another possible boomerang effect, however, and you're starting to see a little of that now with not just cybersecurity issues, but sort of a lack of clarity around how much power, how much data, how much control, not just large entities generally have, but increasingly large tech companies have. And they have enjoyed a great, and deservedly so, a great ride for innovation and kind of being hip and cool. But I think increasingly they're going to be called to account around how opaque or transparent they are around certain practices, how their intermediary function is, you know, properly deployed and available in terms of compliance with laws and regulations and expectations around privacy, around discrimination, around lots of other things. So that's not here yet, but I think over the next 5 or 10 years, one of the unfolding stories is going to be sort of the public's increasing curiosity/skepticism around the aggregation of power around certain large tech companies.
Mm-hmm. It seems like it may evolve into a competition for trust, for who the consumer really wants to trust with their information and their relationship.
Yeah, and I also think that's for sure true. And I think depending on your experience and your circumstance and lots of other things, you know, reputationally, different companies and you have, you know, advantage in that regard. But I think also the question is going to get asked in the future, if you act like a duck, walk like a duck, quack like a duck, you know, what happens to being regulated like a duck? And so as these companies want to enter into what has traditionally been a regulated space with expectations like serving underserved communities, making sure that as a these large programs roll out that they don't have discriminatory effects, that there are transparency around the practices both in front of the curtain and behind the curtain as it relates to consumers and the like, fees, commissions, and who's getting paid in
the business model issues are,
yeah, are so I mean as Amazon wants to get into what looks and sounds like banking, if they do, are they willing to take on the regulatory expectations that have applied to banks?
Yeah. When we think about these big risks, so we've got innovation that's exciting, it's got huge upside opportunity for both the industry and the consumer, or we wouldn't be pursuing it, but it's all intertwined with risk as well,
right,
in terms of the cybersecurity, privacy, fairness, and so on. Do you have a vision of what the solutions are going to be in those areas, or take one at a time? Cybersecurity, are we going to have technology that's going to solve that for us?
I hope so. It's not here yet, but I mean, it is a grave concern. I think most business leaders would say it is their top concern, or certainly a top three concern. Most of the systems, even at the highest levels, have been hacked or are hackable. So you think about what institution has historically been viewed as having the most cyber capabilities. And that would include the NSA, the National Security Agency, and they themselves have been hacked multiple times, including by an insider threat in the form of Edward Snowden. But more recently, housing all sorts of malware that was people hacked into and exfoliated out of the NSA and put into the hands of nefarious actors. You have some of the most sophisticated companies with the most, you know, significant resources being hacked, Equifax being an example. Some of it is just good old-fashioned negligence, sadly, but some of it is what many have said is the internet was designed to be an open, interconnected mm-hmm. platform. It wasn't designed for security. So now you have this phenomena of people retrospectively trying to patch the internet and the applications that flow through to and from on the internet to make them secure. It's very difficult to do. So To answer your question, do I envision a future where we are more secure and totally secure? I hope so. Are we there today? Absolutely not, and it's deeply concerning.
So when you think about the public policy issues that are emerging, what's your best case scenario? What do you think are the top regulatory and policy issues that we
should I think it's calibration and tailoring. So, of course, the country had as an epic event, the financial crisis of 2007, 2008. There was going to be a big muscular response to that, as there should be. I mean, there was behaviors and decisions made leading up to that crisis that were truly awful. And so you could expect, as Congress and regulators reacted to that, that there was going to be a muscular response, and there should have been. And so that led to Dodd-Frank and the passage of Dodd-Frank. And I think appropriately so in terms of a muscular response. But now there's been 7 or 8 or 9 years of experience with Dodd-Frank and the need to look at it and say, well, could this be clarified? Could this be, you know, recalibrated? Not in terms of repeal, not in terms of major or quantum change or retrenchment, but making sure that there's a proper tailoring for certain sizes of institutions, namely not overburdening small institutions that really don't represent systemic risk to the overall system, clarifying certain things. You know, for example, there's an appetite for clarification of the Volcker Rule, not repealing it, but, you know, making it more simplified or streamlined in some ways. So that's the kind of cleanup work that I would say that we're in now that sort of explains this current moment of double checking to make sure Dodd-Frank is properly calibrated. On the tech side, on the fintech side, the financial service sector has done relatively better than most other sectors. You don't often read about large, sophisticated banks, for example, having massive hacks. There are problems, and they're under attack, cyber attack, every day. But they have been more prepared for longer than most other sectors, knock on wood. So I think other sectors have some catching up to do, and I think an interesting question is, should the types of standards that are applied to financial services be applied to other sectors as well? Congress so far has not embraced that or passed that. I think they should. We think they should. We're only as strong as the weakest link, and many other sectors are woefully behind in cyber preparation, cyber resilience, cyber defense, and cybersecurity.
Do you think the regulatory environment around cybersecurity and banking is in good shape at this point then?
It needs to be better on a number of fronts. I wouldn't say good shape. No, we welcome cyber standards, but we want to make sure that the standards that emerge from that at the federal and state level are harmonized and coordinated. So is it helpful to have the CFPB, the Fed, the OCC, the FDIC, the New York, you know, Attorney General, various other states, certain global regulators all be interested in leaning into cyber? Of course. Do we want the standards to be rigorous? Yes. Do we want them to be robust? Yes. And by the way, extend to other sectors. But we also don't want the standards that the government promulgates to be in conflict with each other or in lacking in coordination with each other. So there's a big push to get these cyber standards harmonized, but it's a very difficult work because unless the White House takes control of that and forces it to happen, regulators horizontally mostly don't want to cede any ground or do anything. They don't have vertical authority over each other, so it's sort of an interesting discussion, but the progress in this regard is quite slow.
Yeah, I spend a lot of my time working on this very thing, and I don't think anybody would have designed our U.S. regulatory system as it is now from scratch if we were starting today. But on the other hand, it doesn't seem likely to me we're going to reorganize it.
No. So
we have to make it work better, it seems to me, to get more collaboration, more consistency among the regulators. But it's hard for them.
It's really good. Those are good words. I've been here 5 years. You know, everybody talks like that in meetings and nods their head, and it's polite, and you get regulators in the room from different agencies, and they all agree. But it actually rarely happens, and if it does happen, it happens slowly and incrementally. So I don't, not to be a skeptic about it, but I think in an ideal world, you'd have an entirely more unified and coordinated regulatory structure. Unless and until that changes, it is what it is. And I think the ability for these agencies to self-coordinate with each other is limited.
I think that what might change it is the emergence of risk in the cracks between them or in the overlaps among them, where it begins to, I mean, the change is coming so fast at everybody. That's the new element. It seems to me a lot of the change is very novel, but it's also rapid. And so it seems to me there's risk in not coordinating.
It is, but government largely is a lagging indicator. You know, it's rare that unless you're in an executive position, you know, that they say we're going to plan 10 years ahead and plant a flag on the horizon and drive towards that. They almost always, something bad happens. Right. They hold hearings, they conduct examinations, try to retrospectively figure out what went bad and then pass a new law or rule to make sure something that already happened bad doesn't happen again, which is helpful, but it isn't particularly proactive. And so they're limited in their ability to fast forward.
As a former governor, do you have a view on the respective activities of the federal and state regulators and all this? It's a very, very complicated mosaic.
It is. And again, it, in the category of it is what it is, you probably wouldn't design the system with this much, you know, this many players and this sort of chaotic, not chaotic is the wrong word, but, you know, inviting lack of coordination environment. But everybody has an important role to play. And I think, you know, plowing through all of that is not easy work, but it's important work. And I'm a person who thinks government can often be better when it's closer to the people, so I don't diminish or discount the importance of states' rights and the involvement of state policymakers and the importance of the 10th Amendment. But when you get into certain things that are offered across the country and across the globe, particularly on a mobile basis, you know, you want to have some uniformity in the regulatory approach to such things.
And as you said before, the big tech drivers of this are way bigger than finance. So it's really only secondarily up to the bank type regulators and the financial regulators to figure out how we handle privacy, sort of the intrinsic fairness of AI.
Yeah,
I mean,
and I think
a lot
of
big societal issues.
Yeah,
there.
And I think people are only beginning to realize how much data, you know, people are understandably concerned about data that the government has on each of us. That's an important topic, but that's pretty well vetted in terms of privacy rules. Certainly true for regulated institutions like banks in terms of what they have and what they can give out and the privacy rights around that. I think what's missing in part, or at least underappreciated, is the mass amount of data that's available on people in the unregulated space.
Exactly.
And I think if the average person knew how much certain technology companies know about them, at least for some people, it would be quite unnerving.
Yeah, in banking, we have Regulation P and all the rules around protecting the personally identifiable information that's sensitive, but that's a tiny fragment of the data about people that.
Right, and it's very valuable in a world where artificial intelligence and machine learning is going to be the, you know, one of the dominant drivers of the economy. The it is all about data, and the data is extremely valuable to those kinds of calculations, functions, algorithms. And so I think a rising question is going to be, who owns the data? And by the way, if it's so valuable, should somebody be getting paid for its use?
Yeah.
And I think certain consumer groups and others are going to increasingly start thinking about, you know, do you have the ability, as in Europe and some other places, sort of the right to be forgotten, the right to be deleted, the right to control your own data, not in terms of an annual opt-out, opt-in privacy notice, but sort of an instantaneous click-on, click-off function. And to the extent your data is used in commerce with, in a way that you may not know about, you know, A, should you be told, and B, should you get paid?
Yeah. We have some shows coming up from Europe and lots of, as you say, a really completely different regulatory philosophy there in terms of personal data,
no
how
question.
It can be used. What about distributed ledger technology and blockchains and cryptocurrency and so on? Do you have a view on how significant those are and where they're headed?
Well, it's still emerging and evolving. I think the consensus of many leaders in the industry is that cryptocurrencies are less appealing than blockchain as a distributed ledger technology. So there's a lot of potential applications around blockchain and distributed ledger technology that lots of companies are working on. There's, you know, in beta test mode, there's some early stage stuff that's out there. it's still, in the eyes of some, even though people assert that it is totally secure, there's some security questions that at least need to be probed and answered. But I do think you'll see blockchain and distributed ledger technologies gain some traction over time. Right now, I'd call it emerging. Mm-hmm. On cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin being, of course, the leading example, but there are others. I think they'll continue to be offered. I think a lot has been said about why they exist and what uses they have, and to what extent there's sort of nefarious activity being concealed by some of the use of it. I would say so far it's been sort of a novelty item, but we'll see. I think in the future, it's one thing to put, if you're a modest income person, a little bit of money into Bitcoin because it's fun and it bounces around. But if you have a lot of money, are you going to put a lot of money into that unless you are highly speculative? And also, who's backing it up if it goes poorly?
Yeah.
And over time, if you have value, whether it's in Bitcoin or some other form, decoupled from the monetary supply, let's say that took hold at a dramatic level, not at a marginal level, does that begin to affect the money supply and in terms of the Fed's ability to manage the money supply? If it's, we're talking now about artificially created increments of value that somebody outside of government controls.
Yeah, exactly. It seems like the Fed and other central banks have been pretty hands-off with a lot of this emerging technology and trying to learn the lessons from it, including speeding up the payment system.
Yeah.
Which is probably healthy.
It's happening. Yeah, it is happening. Yeah.
What do you think about the, you touched on this earlier, but the emerging innovation models for the large financial companies and the innovation community, if you want to call it that. One of the things that people talk about a lot is whether the third-party risk rules that face banks are impeding their ability to partner with innovative fintechs and thereby sort of get hold of the cutting edge of some of the innovation that's underway.
Yeah, I don't think that's... I don't think you want to get to a point other than maybe in the so-called sandbox level of magnitude, a point where you say we're going to take off third-party risk management expectations and for banks or for anyone else for that matter. I mean, I think we have regulations to be concerned about in that regard, but everybody else can still get sued if they negligently manage third-party risk managers, i.e. Target and their heating and ventilation contractor that allegedly led to the Target breach or contributed to it. So I don't think that's a big impediment. I think with most banks, let's be candid, they are culturally traditional in their approach, and so in terms of innovation, they can do some of that in-house, but they get a lot of it by investing in companies to get a look at the companies or a seat at the table in the companies. They get a lot of it by partnering. They can get a lot of it by buying, doing merger and acquisition or strategic activities. So, the ability for these banks through M&A, through partnering, through outsourcing R&D to be innovative and compete is actually going quite well, I think. And by the way, the fintech companies, as they have gone through their first, years of investment, need capital, and they are not adverse to partnering with larger institutions in many cases.
Yeah. What aren't we talking about that we should be?
Well, I think we've covered a lot of the larger topics of cybersecurity, fintech, kind of the state of regulation. I do think in this era with this administration, there's this teeter-totter debate around, is the Trump's administration roadmap for regulatory recalibration what's needed, or in the eyes of Elizabeth Warren and some others saying it's going too far? And I think that will unfold over the next few years, particularly within the regulatory realm. But that's sort of in the eye of the beholder. You get arguments on both sides of that. I think lending is always an issue. Is it speeding up? Is it slowing down in the current state? Some would say you're starting to see a slowdown in lending, and some would say, is that a reflection of a economy that's at the end of its recovery? Since World War II, we've had a recession every 7.5 years on average. 9 years is the longest. We're in year 8 of this recovery. So some people are saying, well, it's just the natural slowing down. Other people say you're seeing less lending in part because of regulations being improperly calibrated. There's also people that say you're measuring the wrong thing because a lot of lending has shifted into the so-called shadow banking space.
Have you been looking at RegTech?
Yeah, we have. And I think the ability to automate that has a lot of promise. In fact, there's a RegTech conference in town this week that I'm speaking at.
I'm speaking at tomorrow as well. Yeah. I'll see you again.
Yeah. And, it's got great promise, which is we're going to take all these lawyers and consultants and humans that you got working on these, regulations and get that automated and streamlined. And it's going to be a lot more efficient and it'll drop the cost of your compliance and all of that. And that's terrific aspirationally, but it's still in a nascent stage. And before you can really turn over your compliance functions when, a misstep is a very grave thing to a, lightly tested, lightly used or lightly scaled app or technology that is still, being sold in its early days, that's going to take a while to do proof of concept, but it's going to happen over time. It's just not, most of it's not quite ready yet.
Yeah, it is really new. A lot of people don't even know the term yet.
Yeah, it's very intriguing, which is, we'll automate a bunch of stuff that's expensive and mind-numbing, but it's stuff actually has to work and be reliable. And that's part of the story of fintech generally, which is, hey, every week we got there, this is the really cool thing, it's going to change everything. And it can often be cool, except most of the companies have not yet brought it to scale. They've not yet thought through all of the cyber security issues now and future state. They're also, lightly capitalized, and so that's why they need some partners to come in and say, we'll A, test this, B, see if it can be brought to scale, C, see how much cyber resiliency is around it, and the like.
And as you say, the big banks are doing a lot of sort of lab work with
they're investing or buying or supporting or using some of these fintech companies as vendors, but there's a lot of synergies around that are to the benefit of both.
Yeah. Talk about that. What do you think makes them complementary? What are the respective strengths and weaknesses?
Yeah, the legacy institutions need innovation, need new ideas, need research, some of which they don't always excel at internally. So being able to access that externally is a big plus up for them. And of course, the emerging companies have a limited shelf life. If they don't make some money and break through in the first few years, their funding goes away and they go bankrupt. So they need each other, and finding those right matches for the right reasons is, I think, what makes our economy tick.
Yeah. Do you have advice for any of the sectors, the incumbents, the fintech innovators, and the policymakers?
I don't know that I have advice. I do think a lot about how vulnerable we all are on cybersecurity. And just to take a basic thing like authentication, and as you move towards quantum computing, no matter how weird your password is, in the not too distant future, a very powerful computer can probably break all passcodes.
Yeah, we have to get beyond passwords.
Yeah, and we're now starting to see that maybe facial recognition wasn't all it was cracked up to be, or at least some allegations of that on the new iPhone X and people being able to fool that. And there's speculation around, how fingerprints could be misused. So what is the future of just a basic thing like authentication, and where is that headed in the next phase?
Yeah. So that's the one that worries you.
Well, there's a lot of worry about that. And if you get into financial accounts and they're not insured and the value goes poof in the night, who's responsible for that?
Yeah.
And if you take the example of, you have your money in a certain type of investment account that's not an FDIC account, and some hacker gets in there and spends your money 10 times while you're sleeping all across the globe, and even if you can find where it ended up, there's no way to claw it back. And that happens not for $50, since the company just pays you back, but let's say it's a quantum amount. What does that look like in the next morning in terms of consumer confidence and expectations?
It's an example of where the technology is getting out ahead of the regulatory framework that we have. It's hard to keep up.
It is. The good news is, again, getting back to one of your original questions of trust, you know, I think the industry lost a lot of trust leading up to and the immediate aftermath of the crisis. But people need to keep in mind that these legacy financial institutions are regulated. They have obligations, certain legal obligations that many other companies do not. And they tend to be more advanced when it comes to cybersecurity. And that's not to say bad things can't happen and don't happen, but for the most part, you don't see large, established, regulated financial service companies getting into large-scale cyber problems yet. I think in part because they've been better prepared for it than many others.
Do you think they're going to need to make a big investment in updating their IT? There's a lot of talk about that the big banks
yes.
tend to have.
Go ahead. Yeah. Well, they all do. Everybody yeah. does. I mean, I don't know of a company that doesn't constantly ask and answer the question, how much more do we need to put into IT and how much is enough and is there ever enough given how rapidly the threats are evolving and changing on a weekly basis.
Yeah. How do you keep up with technology yourself? Are you a technophile?
You know, I don't pretend to be a technologist, but I like to be an end user of it on a consumer level, and I'm a hobbyist when it comes to reading about it, studying it, and of course I'm immersed with it day to day and part of my job. One of the things we have here at the Roundtable is a group called BITS, which is one of our divisions. All they do all day, every day, is focus on cybersecurity policy. And it's one of those things that is fascinating, it's interesting, it's important. It's also one of those things that the more you know about it, the more you worry about it, because there's large gaps. We had Steve Wozniak, of course, one of the co-founders of Apple, at one of our meetings not long ago, and I had a chance to interview him. I asked him about cybersecurity, and he said, you know, there's really no good answer because the internet was meant to be open. And it was designed that way. And he said, if you really want security, you got to go back, at least for certain functions, to closed systems. And you know, that his view was, that's really the only ultimate answer.
That is thought-provoking, because there's a whole school of thought that what we're going toward is open and platform banking. More and more ability to, with the bank, connected to the payment system and the other players working on their platform.
And there's very different expectations, as you know, with my children or perhaps yours of a certain age. They have very different view around privacy and, you know, how they view some of these things, not in terms of being hacked, but in terms of, you know, certain elements of their information being available to companies. Some of them seem less troubled by it than people my age.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Yeah. There's definitely a cultural shift. Well, I know we're out of time. I'm enjoying talking with you. I'm sure we could go much longer, but is there anything you want to add that we haven't talked about?
No, I just think the financial service industry, while it can be viewed as a little dry for a lot of people, you know, you think about what every day, every American and most people around the rest of the world touch numerous financial service products and need them, and their life would be difficult without them. So you think about credit cards, debit cards, checking accounts, savings accounts, you know, home loans, business loans, life insurance, property and casualty insurance, 401ks, IRAs, you know, the list goes on and on. But, you know, this system needs to work. It is like the plumbing of the economy. And it may not be glamorous, it may not be, you know, headline news unless something bad happens, but this plumbing needs to work, and it needs to work efficiently for people to be able to go about their daily lives and not worry about it. So making sure this infrastructure, i.e. plumbing, works is important work, and we hopefully are contributing to that.
Where can people get more information about the Roundtable?
If they're interested in our group or any of these issues, information's available at fsroundtable.org.
Great. Well, Tim Pawlenty, thank you so much for being my guest today. It's
Happy
been
to
wonderful
do it.
Talking.
Thanks for having me.
I hope you enjoyed my talk with Financial Services Roundtable CEO Tim Pawlenty. Please come to jsbarefoot.com for the show notes that have links to a lot more information about the Roundtable, including its BITS organization that works with technology, and also to many of the things that we talked about. Before I introduce some information about upcoming shows, let me remind everyone also to listen to the recent one that we did with Nick Cook of the UK's Financial Conduct Authority about the future of regulation. Especially if you're a regulator or maybe know some regulators, that show is not to be missed. It is totally groundbreaking in thinking about how we're going to move forward with digitally native regulation. There's a lot of more activity emerging in that space, which we'll talk about in future shows. So please be sure that of everything we've run recently, you don't miss listening to that one. We have some wonderful episodes coming up. One is going to be with Cross River Bank CEO Gilles Gade, who is going to talk about the sponsor bank model for fintechs working with banking partners. We have two coming up in London with the wonderful CEO of Starling Bank, Anne Bowden, and another with Innovate Finance CEO Charlotte Crosswell. Be sure, meanwhile, to be registering for the Innovate Finance Global Summit in March. There's a link to that in the show notes. We also have shows coming up with Michael Wiegand, who heads the Gates Foundation's work on financial services for the poor, and with NerdWallet CEO Tim Chen, as well as many more. I also hope to see you at upcoming events. Some of the ones I'm going to be at include the aforementioned Innovate Finance Global Summit in March in London. I'll be at Bank Directors, The Reality of RegTech in April in New York. I'll be keynoting the Texas Bankers Association Annual Conference in May in Houston. I will be speaking at Comply 2018 in New York, and I'll be at the American Bankers Association Regulatory Compliance Conference in June in Nashville. I'll be moderating a general session panel there on regulation and artificial intelligence, and also teaming up again this year with the ABA to do some very special podcasts. As always, don't forget to review Barefoot Innovation on iTunes and sign up to get our emails that can bring you the latest podcast and newsletter and blog posts at jsbarefoot.com. Follow me on Twitter at JoAnneBarefoot and join my Facebook fan page. And please, please send in your Buck a Show to keep Barefoot Innovation going. We will see you next time.